Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, today's conversation, it's about the ballooning of America. There are diets, a new diet pill, but should the government get involved in fighting obesity the way it became involved in cigarette smoking? But first, congressional Democrats demanded answers from former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and former generals, asking what they knew when about the 2004 death of one of the most famous U.S. soldiers, football star turned Army Ranger Pat Tillman. The military first said he was killed in enemy fire, then later admitted it had been friendly fire. Rumsfeld told lawmakers at a hearing today that he doesn't recall how he learned Tillman was killed by friendly fire, information that was kept from the Tillman family and the public for a month. But Rumsfeld also said,
I know that I would not engage in a cover-up. I know that no one in the White House suggested such a thing to me. I know that the gentlemen sitting next to me are men of enormous integrity and would not participate in something like that.
Rumsfeld was sitting with the generals. Democrats think the White House is withholding information. A seventh and possibly final Army investigation into Tillman's death, released yesterday, censored one Army general and reprimanded six other officers for failures of leadership and procedural errors, but also concluded there was no cover-up. Well, joining us on the line from Capitol Hill is Dimitri Stevastopoulos, Pentagon correspondent for the Financial Times. I know you're in a busy quarter there, Dimitri. But tell us first, did we learn anything new today about why it took a month for the Army to publicly acknowledge that Pat Tillman was killed by friendly fire?
We learned some new things, but there are some questions that remain unanswered. The hearing centered really on the question of a memo called a personal form memo that a general in the field sent to General John Abagay, who was the head of CENTCOM at the time, and also to General Kensington, who was the general who was reprimanded yesterday that you mentioned a couple of minutes ago. And this memo said, it was a week after Pat Tillman's death, that there was a possibility that he was killed by friendly fire. And the question of the hearing was, why did it take almost a month from the time that that memo was issued for Donald Rumsfeld and other senior leaders to find out that this had happened? Rumsfeld himself said he never saw the memo, he knew nothing about it. General Abzaid said he got it a week later because of problems in communications. He called General Myers, Richard Myers, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and General Myers says that, he didn't say what he did. He didn't talk to the White House. No one talked to the White House. So the question is, why did no one talk to the White House? The only answer that they've given is that they didn't want to be seen as influencing an investigation. There's a thing in the military called command influence, and they all said they didn't want to get involved in an investigation until it was complete.
And again, just to clarify, because you are there in a busy Congress corridor, this was the memo from Lieutenant General Philip Kessinger, who, again, was censored yesterday. You tell me, because I may have misheard. Who wrote the memo to Abizay?
The memo was sent by General McChrystal, and it was sent to General Abizay and also to General Kensington, who was censored yesterday.
I see.
The memo was sent a week after Corporal Tillman's death, and it raised the possibility of fratricide. And the question was, why it took more than a month for that, over a month, almost 6 weeks, for the family to be informed that it was a possible fratricide, which is supposed to happen under Army regulations.
Right. What other information does Committee Chair Henry Waxman think is being withheld?
Well, one of the questions he raised was, after the news emerged that Corporal Tillman was leaving behind a very lucrative contract and sports career to go and serve in Afghanistan and join the Rangers, there were lots of emails back and forth talking about this on the White House email server. But there don't appear to be any emails that have been forthcoming after his death. And the question was, if there was so much talk about Corporal Tillman when he signed up, it's inconceivable that there was no talk on email or email chatter about his death when it became public. And so I think Congressman Waxman wants to find some of those emails and see what they say.
We also understand that Waxman started the hearing by speaking of the testimony of a soldier who'd been next to Tillman, whose testimony was altered, and it's still unknown who did that.
Yes, it's still unclear who did that. I mean, yesterday the censure of General Kensington accused him of lying to investigators, but it still has not emerged in the investigations who actually altered the initial testimony from one of the junior troops, saying that there was a possibility or that actually it had been fratricide and not
enemy fire that had killed Colton Tillman.
Dmitry Sevastopolo, Pentagon correspondent for the Financial Times. We just have a few seconds. The Tillmans were in the audience today. They've said that they don't accept a lot of what's going on. How did they respond?
We haven't seen any response yet. They've been very quietly sitting in the audience. I mean, the General Secretary Rumsfeld apologized, but without taking direct responsibility. And they all said that there has been no cover-up. But we haven't seen how the Tillmans themselves have responded yet.
Dmitry, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin. Bye.
Americans are expected to spend about $60 billion next year in an often futile attempt to lose weight. It wasn't always so. Time magazine reports that just two decades ago, less than 50% of adults were overweight. Today, two-thirds are, and half of them are obese. Yes, we know, with cars and high technology, Americans walk less than they used to. They sit in front of computers, eat highly processed food. But we've also invented health clubs and health foods. Admittedly, these cost money and they aren't accessible to everyone, but we have hundreds of diets, so why are Americans still ballooning? One theory, we're genetically predisposed. As evolving hunter-gatherers, our ancestors needed to eat every few minutes, especially sugary fruits and salt, just to survive. And now our genes are telling us to keep it up. But the occasional foraged berry has been replaced by a supersized meal. So what to do? Well, joining us is Dr. Michael Danziger, an obesity researcher at Tufts New England Medical Center here in Boston, an expert in the serious diets and procedures available today. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
You've evaluated the diets out there. You say they fall into four main categories. So take us through those.
On the one end, there's very high carbohydrate, low-fat diets. The Ornish low-fat vegetarian diet is a great example of that. Then there's the moderate-fat diets. A great example of that would be the Weight Watchers plan or the USDA food pyramid plan that strikes for balance and moderation. Have a certain amount of fruits and a certain amount of vegetables and a certain generous amount of whole grains and have fat. Healthy fat in particular. Don't go overboard on the fat, but be sure to include fat. Then there's what I call the moderate carbohydrate plans. These plans avoid refined starchy foods, especially things like white rice, white bread, white pasta, sugar, and focus mainly on lean proteins, fruits, and vegetables. The Zone diet is a great example of that. South Beach diet. And then there's the very low-carb approach, like Atkins diet, which is going to be high in protein and vegetables and low in fruit and other sources of carbohydrates.
Do you find that any one works better than the other?
That's a great question. We published a study 2 years ago to answer the question whether an Atkins, a Zone, a Weight Watchers, or an Ornish-style diet produced most weight loss, and we found it to be a four-way tie. At the end of a year, we
really
found that the amount of weight loss was about the same, and for people who stuck to their plans pretty closely, about 10 to 15 pounds was the weight loss that we saw, and all groups had improvements in their heart disease risk factors.
Before we move on, I just want to touch on questions that have been raised about each of them. For instance, with the Atkins diet, this is the low-carb diet. When they say no more than 20 grams of carbs a day for the first phase, they mean about a slice of bread. So that's low for a lot of people. First 14 days, no fruit, bread, pasta, grains, milk, or even ketchup. You start adding them. It's supposed to start a state of ketosis, which forces your body to burn fat. But somebody, a man sued the Atkins estate, saying that it caused clogged arteries. Is there anything you want to mention about the diets that you'd have concern about?
The Atkins diet is the main one that's been criticized, and I think that the criticism of the Atkins diet is unwarranted and has been refuted in large part by the half a dozen or more clinical trials looking at the Atkins diet. Now, clearly it's not for everyone, and it's difficult for most people to stick to, but if you look at the science, I'd give it two thumbs up.
Just a quick question about Dr. Ornish's diet, which is very low fat. He says if you cut out fats, you eat more food. He advises avoiding all meats, oils, high-fat dairy. Some people worry that people who get on these diets may go too far and don't have, for instance, in this case, enough fat.
I disagree with any concerns about the Ornish diet. I think it's a great diet. The Ornish diet is the only one proven to help reverse heart disease. It's reliable for weight loss. And any heart disease patient that I can get to follow the Ornish diet, I wouldn't hesitate to recommend it.
How do you, when someone comes to you and wants to lose weight, and they're serious because they're coming to a doctor, how do you evaluate who needs which one?
Oh, it's a great art. A person's medical conditions, food preferences, and lifestyle are all factors that will predict their level of adherence. There are certain people who will do very well on an Atkins-style diet. These are people who love meat, cheese and eggs, who would not miss fruit terribly, people who might have a little bit of a nonconformist streak to them. Certain people will do very poorly with an extreme diet. These are people who like to go along with the flow, people who are striving for balance in their life, people who don't want to buck the system, people who want a lot of approval from their doctors and from others might do very well on a mainstream, and people who want to maximize the variety in their eating plan. These are people who do well on a moderate approach.
So it's a psychological profile, too, to see which one fits.
That's right.
Well, let's talk about drugs. As you know, there's one that's come out on the market. It was highly anticipated. It's called Ally.
I have mainly positive things to say about this particular weight loss drug. Ally has been available over the counter for a few weeks now. It's a non-prescription version of a prescription medication called Xenical, which has been available for many years in the United States. The reason that they've made it available over the counter is because it does not seem to have any dangerous side effects. It does have side effects.
Well, let's ask you about that, because we had heard that this is a fat blocker. It apparently prevents about 25% of fat from being absorbed by the intestines. We understood that there could be serious problems with it if it's used by people who eat too much fat, that they could have, well, they lose control of their bowels.
If you eat too much fat at a particular meal, then you will have too much undigested fat in your bowel, and it will cause risk for leakage and diarrhea, bloating, cramping, and discomfort. Mm. You take a pill at the beginning of each meal, and you try not to eat more than 15 grams of fat. A salad with an oil salad dressing would probably be in that neighborhood. A breakfast of eggs and toast with margarine would probably fall into that category.
A Big Mac would not fall into that category.
There's more than 15 grams of fat in a Big Mac,
yeah.
I believe.
Yeah, I think it's what...
That's when you're going to get the problems.
Yeah. You know, there are a lot of people who are just against any kind of medication. How do you feel about diet pills in general, other pills as well?
In general, I'm thumbs down on diet pills because I think it's an artificial solution to the problem. It's going to be expensive. It's not a viable long-term solution. And when you go off the pill, the weight comes back.
Do we know, I mean, you talked about the side effect of, the loss of control of your stools if you eat fat. But what about, the concerns about the old diet pills was that they, damaged your heart.
This type of pill does not get absorbed into your body, so I think it's at very low risk of having hidden effects on your heart or your brain. That's why I feel least uncomfortable with this particular pill. However, all pills have side effects, and many times we're surprised years down the road by some unexpected issue. So that does give me pause and mixed feelings. Plus, my area of emphasis is helping people learn how to change their eating and their exercise in a way that is going to be lifelong. And that takes more than a pill.
That's obesity researcher Dr. Michael Danziger. He's going to be back with the newest surgery. Quick note, later in the show, some kids are already back at school. We'll have the battle over the school calendar back after a break here and now. And Young, it's here and now, and we're back with more from Dr. Michael Danziger, an obesity researcher at Tufts New England Medical Center here in the Boston area. We've been talking about America's growing waistline and ways to be healthier, from dieting to taking diet pills. When all else fails, Americans are resorting to medical procedures to lose weight. We know that. There's been a dramatic increase in the number of weight-related surgeries from 37,000 in the year 2000 to 177,000 last year. So, Dr. Danziger, let's start by talking about one of the most common, the gastric bypass, commonly known as a stomach staple. Can you explain that and how it works?
You're stapling the stomach in a way that makes it a very small pouch, maybe 20% of the size of the stomach is available for food to go in. And in large part, because there's less room for food, you get full more quickly. Mm-hmm. Now, it's much more complicated than that, but That's right. A sufficient explanation. And that surgery works pretty well. People can usually expect to lose about, 70, 80, 90 pounds, and to keep two-thirds of that weight off for at least a decade, according to, published research evidence. It's a great solution. It's a desperate solution.
For severely obese people.
Yes, it's the best way to reverse diabetes in people who are seriously overweight. I'm generally enthusiastic about weight loss surgery. It's so invasive, and people can die from it. 1% risk of death. So you got to be in an extreme circumstance to go for a solution like that.
Your obesity may also be running the risk of death as well. So I guess you have to weigh that with a doctor.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a very important concern. There's a less invasive approach that's become more popular and sort of perfected over the last couple of years called the lap band procedure. I don't perform lap band procedures. I'm not a surgeon, but the general idea is that you just use a band inserted laparoscopically, meaning they make about a 1-inch incision. Just push this band into your abdomen and wrap the stomach around it, analogous to a twist tie. And then now you have a little pouch that's a fraction of your original stomach size, and that works essentially in a similar but not identical manner to the more invasive surgery. The amount of weight loss might be about half or two-thirds of what you could expect with the full surgery, and you can feel free that there's virtually no risk of death from a procedure like that. The results are maybe halfway, and you're taking a much lower risk, and so for many people, I would consider that a good compromise, somewhere between the difficulty of adhering to a diet versus the extreme approach from the full surgery.
Well, Dr. Danziger, I mean, it really has been sort of the ballooning of America. Do you have hope that it will be reversed? It will change?
Yes, I'm optimistic. I'll give you four reasons. The majority of people out there are already leading by example. They're not eating everything in sight. They are trying to exercise. And that's one important reason why I'm optimistic for the future. Another reason is if for people who are seeking healthy food, there's never been a better time. The variety of fruits and vegetables in the market is astounding. There's even healthy prepared foods out there. There are recipes from every culture. It's a great time to be interested in healthy eating. Thirdly, although weight loss efforts in the past have been disappointing, I think that scientists have the ability, and the healthcare system has the ability, to improve their ability to provide lifestyle coaching to their patients. And I think we have a great opportunity for improving this area. And then fourthly, I believe in the power of the people. We have a government that can respond to our needs. And it might be sluggish at times, but if the people want something done, we have a tradition in this country of being able to do it. Sometimes it has to get to desperate measures before government action can kick in. But if we want to elect leaders who are willing to help us change the environment that will help promote adherence to lifestyle changes, we can do so. We can start to limit unhealthy advertising of food to children. We can start funding greater efforts in schools to teach our children how to adhere to lifestyle efforts.
Well, how far do you think that should go? Because, when you say that, I'm thinking of like the campaign against the last thing that was killing Americans, which is tobacco. Many Americans are dying from obesity. Do you think there should be taxes on Twinkies or warnings, health warnings on processed, highly processed food?
I think that government has potential and power to implement changes that will make a difference, and I think it should do so in a manner that reflects what the American public wants. Now, I think that reasonable Americans would want the government to intervene to a moderate degree. For example, small taxes on soft drinks, I think, would be highly acceptable to Americans. For example, a 1-cent tax on soft drinks would double the amount of money available for obesity research compared to now. I think parents and the public in general would be in favor of removing candy and
vending machines
from schools. I think that they would be in favor of eliminating advertising of unhealthy cereal to children during cartoons. I think there are many moderate steps that would be compatible with the interests of the American public, and I think right now the government is behind, is not correctly reflecting what Americans want. Clearly, they don't want to make Twinkies illegal or to eliminate McDonald's or to take extreme steps like that. But the moderate road, I think, is something that we're going to be pursuing more in the future.
We've been talking with Dr. Michael Danziger, an obesity researcher at Tufts New England Medical Center here in the Boston area, talking about weight loss trends and weight gain trends in the U.S. And Doctor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, what do you think about this or anything on the program? We'd love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give a call. You can leave a message at 617-358-0397. And when you're at our website, here-now.org, remember you can hear our show stream live anytime or click on archives for past programs or download a podcast and take us with you wherever you go. That's here-now.org. Tomorrow on Here and Now, he wrote the book on how the U.S. managed Iraq after Saddam Hussein fell, and now he writes he sees no reason to change that title. We'll speak with Tom Ricks, author of Fiasco. Still ahead today, the story of pianist Leon Fleischer. He lost the use of one hand, then through Botox and Rolfing, he's playing again. That's all after the news, Here and Now. Robin Young, it's Here and Now. It was all about the relationship. The nuclear agreement formally announced last week between India and the U.S. essentially welcomes India into the nuclear club. Under the deal's terms, India will be granted free trade in nuclear reactors, technology, and fuel to develop its civilian nuclear facilities while still retaining its military nuclear program. But wait a minute, wasn't it India's first test of a nuclear bomb in 1974 that so scared the U.S. and helped shape the nuclear nonproliferation movement? What happened here, and what happens next? With us is Shumit Ganguly, professor of political science and research director for the Center on American and Global Security at Indiana University. He's also the author of two books on India and its relation to the U.S. and nuclear weapons. And professor, this sounds like a great deal for India. North Korea wouldn't mind a deal like this. What does the U.S. get out of it?
The U.S. gets quite a bit out of the deal. For example, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is estimating that about $100 billion of trade in nuclear components and technology lies ahead for the United States. That's from a purely commercial standpoint. Secondly, the U.S. also benefits from a markedly improved relationship with India. This demonstrates a certain amount of faith in India, that India will not violate the terms of this agreement and will not divert fuel to drive its nuclear weapons program. So this also helps transform the diplomatic character of the relationship and puts the strategic relationship with India on a completely different plane.
As India sits between Pakistan and China, we understand, too, that there's the politics of it, Democrats and Republicans both eyeing Indian Americans, not just for their vote, but for their high-tech money in a presidential campaign.
There's no question about that. I think there is an eye firmly cocked on the wallets of Indian Americans, because apart from the Jewish community, I think Indian Americans constitute the second wealthiest ethnic group in the country.
Well, let's go through what were some of the sticking points in a tough two-year negotiation. India insisted on being allowed to reprocess its spent fuel from civilian nuclear power. Spent fuel, as we know, is how you make plutonium to make weapons. So what did India say they wanted it for, and why were they allowed to keep it?
Well, thus far, the United States has allowed the European community and Japan to reprocess spent fuel. And the Indians felt that they needed to have their authority to be able to reprocess spent fuel to boost what is called their fast breeder reactor program. This is a sort of the next generation of technology in terms of generating nuclear power. And India, which has long had a civilian nuclear program, it started in 1946. The Indians are passionately committed to this. Mm-hmm. And there was widespread opposition in India to the deal unless this component was included in the deal.
Well, and it seems that what the U.S. got in return was that this spent fuel would be kept at a facility under international safeguards.
That is precisely correct.
India also insisted on the right to keep a strategic reserve, the reasoning?
Yes, because of India's past experience with the United States, where the U.S. basically reneged on a bilateral commitment to continue to provide India nuclear fuel after India tested its first nuclear weapon in 1974. And the French were allowed to step into the breach. And because of this memory of the U.S. cutting off nuclear fuel, the Indians had been rather adamant that there would be the spent fuel reserve.
India also got to keep its military nuclear facilities. We've been speaking just of the civilian nuclear facilities that provide energy. They got to keep their military facilities totally off limits to any international inspection. But what are the safeguards there?
There are really no safeguards on those eight reactors. Those eight reactors will remain, at least for the foreseeable future, outside the scope of International Atomic Energy Agency safeguards.
Has India said whether it will test again, and has the U.S. said what it might do if India does?
India reserves the right to test, but for all practical purposes. I cannot imagine, except in the most exigent circumstances, the Indians once again resorting to nuclear testing. Because, quite frankly, regardless of what assurances the Bush administration provides, in the event India tests, I cannot imagine even a Republican-dominated Congress taking this lying down. I think there would be inexorable pressures in the United States to impose sanctions on India were India to resume testing. Mm.
Okay, but just to be clear, none of that is in writing in this deal. And let's review, the context of this. All countries, as we understand, with nuclear capability, except Israel, Pakistan, and India, have signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Iran is now accused of being in violation of the treaty they signed. But India hasn't signed, as we said. So why is India being allowed all of this free trade through this new deal when it hasn't signed? Is it just some of the political and diplomatic issues we talked about?
I think it goes beyond that. I think that's certainly one strand of it. But the most important thing is that India actually has not violated any of the terms of the NPT, even though it's never really been a member of the regime. India has not been a proliferant country, for one thing. It has maintained its safeguards on its nuclear facilities and has not allowed the dissipation of nuclear technology or material from its facilities.
Whereas some could point to Pakistan and A.Q. Khan, like the scientist who did send materials out of the country.
That's precisely the case.
Well, the irony here, though, for many, is that, as we said, U.S. policy on nuclear nonproliferation was pretty much shaped in great part as a response to India's test in 74. It just seems as if it's come full circle, with maybe the message being sent to countries like Iran and North Korea that sort of it doesn't matter if you were a bad boy, as it were.
There are two critical differences to bear in mind. Unlike North Korea or Iran, India has not been involved in the proliferation game, whereas North Korea and Iran were part and parcel of a nuclear Walmart. They were also adherents to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and have blatantly violated the terms of the treaty. So I think India is in a unique position. And furthermore, unlike North Korea and Iran, both of which have fairly harsh authoritarian regimes, India is a democratic state.
Well, the deal did have opponents in India, peace activists, some of the left-wing parties, and scientists who, on the other side of the coin, worried about signing a deal and losing Indian sovereignty. But I'm wondering, here in the U.S., what happens next? It still has to be approved by Congress?
Yes, of course. It does have to be approved by Congress. And there is a group within Congress, a bipartisan nonproliferation group, which still has some reservations about the deal. And they probably will kick up a little bit of a fuss.
Shumeet Ganguly is professor of political science and research director for the Center on American and Global Security at Indiana University. He's also author of Fearful Symmetry, India and Pakistan Under the Shadow of Nuclear Weapons, and More Than Words, U.S.-India Strategic Cooperation into the 21st Century, which we've just been talking about. Professor, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Okay, before we go today, pianist Leon Fleischer returns to the stage after a debilitating illness. His story's now on film. You're listening to Here and Now. Ah, summer. Kids enjoying camp, vacationing with their parents, maybe hanging out, or starting school. Yep, kids in Mitchell and Seminole Counties, Georgia, started on July 23rd. And by the second week in August, schools throughout most of Georgia, Kentucky, and Alabama will also be open. It's all part of a move to extend the school calendar. Supporters say kids retain more knowledge with a shorter summer break. But Tina Bruno is one of thousands of parents who've organized in protest. She's a mother of three and executive director of both Texans for a Traditional School Year and the Coalition for a Traditional School Year, which helped push through a Texas state law mandating a later start date. Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Florida all have the same laws. Tina joins us now. And Tina, you know the arguments. The National Association for Year-Round Education says an earlier summer start means kids are better prepared for standardized testing. And in fact, in Mitchell County, Georgia, this district that started last week, 60% of the schools didn't make adequate yearly progress under the No Child Left Behind testing. So let's start with that. Don't schools need extra time to prepare kids?
Starting school in early August or late July doesn't necessarily give kids more time of instruction before the standardized tests. What we see is that they actually are getting more holidays and more breaks.
You're saying that instead of taking the earlier time in the summer, what, don't take the breaks during the year?
Correct. What we see is when school districts start school very early, one of the things you see is actually more vacation days between the first and last day of school. And what that does is cause a lot more interruption and reduces time on task.
Well, what about the other argument that if you start the school, well, they say later, but the traditional start, then the kids get to take their tests before the Christmas recess rather than after?
Well, actually, the top 10 academic states in the country, based on the American Legislative Exchange Council's ratings, the majority start school at the end of August, beginning of September, and they give exams after the winter break. There's actually a concept called the spacing effect that psychologists have looked at for over 20 years, and it shows that it's better for kids to have the information presented, to be able to study it, and then have a break before they go back and review and then go into their testing. And what that does is to make sure that the kids are actually understanding the information. It's the old argument of retention versus regurgitation.
Yeah, it's funny because that's, of course, the exact opposite of what the people at the National Association for Year-Round Education say. They say that it's the break that makes kids forget. So you have, you know, two sets of research.
Research can always be bought and paid for. So I like to look at what the top academic schools are really doing. Let's look at their calendars.
But do you have any sympathy for some of the teachers who are behind this extending the calendar movement? I'm reading of one, Tommy Benton. He's a Georgia lawmaker now, but he was a history teacher. He says he's against these statewide bans on early starts because it's districts who should determine what's best for them. I mean, a district might have a particular problem, and they might need to do this, and a ban won't allow them to do it.
Well, there's no research that I've ever seen that shows that when you start school impacts academics at all. And really, the state should be very concerned about when school's starting because the state is responsible for providing the bulk of funding. And research has shown that when you start school in early August, you're paying a lot more for electricity, meaning a lot of the money that we could be putting into academic programming, into teacher salaries, is really going out the window in cooling costs.
Well, what are some of the other things like that that people might not think of unless they have kids they're trying to get through the summer? What's the other impact?
Well, one of the big impacts that I can tell you with my children is when school starts in early August, kids are not excited about going back to the classroom. It is this, oh my goodness, school's starting. Excitement really impacts learning. And teachers have told us when school starts early, we have more discipline problems. The kids are not focused. They're not wanting to do projects. because there's 101 other things that they still want to do.
We also understand that high schoolers can't work as much during the summer. Families have a hard time planning their vacations.
Well, they do. And also, there are wonderful activities in the summer that augment the curriculum of the schools. Those don't exist when you have to find a babysitter or a daycare center to watch your child every Friday during a certain month because there's no school.
Well, Tina Bruno, again, a Texas mother of three, executive director of the Coalition for a Traditional School Year, successfully deflecting the early start there in the Texas area. Just real brief, your kids must be thanking you.
It's funny because at the pool, all the kids are, "You did this, didn't you? Yay!" They're all, but I see that they're starting to get excited now for school. They're starting to look forward to it. Where in the past, I have never seen that.
Tina Bruno, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And in a moment, we're going to take a minute break. When we come back, pianist Leon Fleischer, Here and Now. Robin Young, It's Here and Now. We have some quick news from entertainment. In a move which took observers in a Los Angeles courtroom by surprise, attorneys for Phil Spector said they plan to wrap up their defense today. Spector, the legendary music producer whose wall of sound recording technique revolutionized rock music, is accused of murdering actress Lana Clarkson in 2003. Defense witnesses say Clarkson killed herself. Before court recessed yesterday, Spector's former lead lawyer, Bruce Cutler, who bowed out of the trial for 3 weeks to film a TV show, said he was again leaving Spector's side to tape more episodes. The judge, Larry Fidler, warned Spector that if he continues to use Cutler and is convicted, he must give up his right to come back at a later time and say, "My attorney wasn't there." In his first comment during the whole trial, Spector replied, "I'll discuss it with him." Musicians revere pianist Leon Fleischer for his early concerto recordings with conductor George Zell and the Cleveland Orchestra in the late 50s. Just listen to this rendition of Beethoven's Fourth Piano Concerto. But where Beethoven was robbed of his hearing, Fleischer was robbed of his fingers. In the early 60s, he had to cancel a tour after contracting a rare neurological condition called focal dystonia. This debilitating ailment curved and stiffened two fingers of Fleischer's right hand and forced him into early retirement. But over the past 5 years, Fleischer has returned to the two-handed repertoire after breakthrough treatments of Botox and Rolfing muscle therapy. Tomorrow night, Cinemax will broadcast an Oscar-nominated documentary about Fleischer called, appropriately enough, Two Hands. And Here and Now's Tim Riley has a preview of Fleischer's soaring third act.
To most pianists, Leon Fleischer is a heavyweight champ who was sidelined in his prime. His Beethoven and Brahms concerto cycles made him a contender to the crowns worn by both Van Cliburn and Glenn Gould, the young sensations of his era. Many of us thought we'd never get the chance to hear Fleischer record or perform again. Two Hands, the new documentary by Nathaniel Kahn, tells the story of his comeback through Fleischer's own chiseled yet intimate voice, as though he's waking from a bad dream in his late 70s. He remembers a minor injury in the early 1960s, and then, after returning to his practicing, nothing seemed quite the same.
And I noticed that things didn't feel quite right in my right arm. Bit by bit, fifth and fourth finger wanted to just kind of curl under. And this got progressively worse. The gods know where to hit you when they want to hit you.
His career put on hold, Fleischer went into a deep depression. But no matter how many doctors told him he would never play again, he somehow felt as though he just might.
Because it seemed to have come out of the blue. I kept thinking, well, maybe it'll go away out of the blue. And then, you know, after about 2 years came this awareness, this realization that my connection was to music and not just to playing this piano with two hands.
Exiled from the concert career he seemed destined for, Fleischer turned to teaching and then conducting, carving a place for himself in the music world, which earned him the directorship of the Tanglewood Music School and a prestigious class of students at the Peabody Institute of Music in Baltimore. There was even an early comeback in 1982 that didn't pan out. After undergoing tendonitis surgery, the result of clutching his conducting baton too hard, he felt as though his right hand may have healed entirely. He was booked to play the opening concert at the new Meyerhoff Hall in Baltimore. But as the concert approached, Fleischer knew the surgery hadn't fixed his hand.
And I remember being backstage in the dressing room before going out and playing, and just breaking down, bursting into tears. But it was, it would have to be an evening of pretense.
Part of Fleischer's battle with his right-hand fingers was to get medical specialists to diagnose exactly what was going on. His doctor, Daniel Drachman, says it took painstaking patience to find a solution.
Leon has dystonia. We don't know exactly what it is, but it certainly is not the fingers, not the nerves, not the muscles, but it is something within the brain. Somehow the brain has learned to do a wrong thing.
Today, even the fact that I am playing with two hands, I am a dystonic. I have dystonia, and there ain't no way of getting rid of it. Those two fingers still want to curl under. I'm still fighting this neurological message that my brain is sending my muscles to curl under. You know, there's no cure for focal dystonia. It's just that Botox and something like Rolfing for me help deal with the symptoms.
Fleischer's condition constrains his repertoire, but he turns this into a virtue. In 1994, his left-hand recital CD made a lot of two-handers feel jealous. Music America crowned him Instrumentalist of the Year. On his new CD, The Journey, he revisits some of the keyboard's most familiar melodies. Here Fleischer plays Beethoven's Führer Lisa, a bagatelle which is commonly used to teach young students. Doesn't sound like a student piece in Fleischer's hands. It's almost too good to be true. Fleischer's playing has deepened, grown more soulful after his years away from the keyboard. He's had so much time to think about his ideal sound that his return lets him satisfy years of itching fingers. There's an immense gratitude in this playing, and an expansive sense of how much the piano can do.
The experiences that I've gone through as a result of all this, the extraordinary joys and pleasures that have come from teaching and through the left-hand literature and through conducting, I don't think I would give those experiences and joys up. If I had it to do over again, I'm not that sure that I would have changed anything.
Leon Fleischer performing Bach's chorale, Sheep May Safely Graze. It's featured in the Cinemax documentary about Fleischer, which airs tomorrow. Here now is Tim Riley, writes a classical music page at the RileyRockIndex.com. You can get to it by going to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now. Thank you.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.